This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to Conda Mason's Brown Rice Hour, a podcast that quilts together a fabric of connection between land, race, money, culture, and spirit. Discover a connection that engages with the most inspiring and cutting-edge thought leaders today, pointing toward our collective healing and liberation. If you are interested in supporting the Brown Rice Hour, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Conda.
Hi.
Hi.
Well,
you have such a good radio voice, Conda.
Oh, well, thank you. Really? got that deep voice. I am welcoming you to my podcast. I'm Conda Mason, and this is my new podcast that is called The Brown Rice Hour. And The Brown Rice Hour is, we're having conversations, intersectional conversations, of land, race, money, culture, and spirit. And I am super excited to have you with me today. Today I have my good dear friend and comrade, Anasa Troutman, with me. And thank you for saying yes, Anasa.
Asking me, I would never say no to you. That was never even a thing.
Not even a thing.
That's never even a thing.
That's really
good. I mean, it's already you, but then you want to talk about all my favorite things all at one time. Yes.
I know, right? I know. There's so much to talk about. There's so much to talk about all those issues. And so I always begin by opening up sacred space. And one of the things that I do is just acknowledge the land where we are, the indigenous land. And I'm on Ohlone land here in Oakland, California, the Ohlone people. And I wanted to ask you if you know the indigenous people of the land where you are.
You know, I do know. And we have been doing this community engagement process for the past 6 weeks, I guess, over at Claiborne Temple. And we wrote this whole land acknowledgement that we read every week for everybody. And I'm trying to find it so I can read it to you because it's really beautiful.
Lovely.
I might not be able to find it quickly, though. So
okay. Well, I probably
maybe I'll have to come back to that.
Yeah, you can come back.
And I can edit it in.
Exactly. We can edit it in.
Yes.
So as the other part of sacred space, I like to just acknowledge our ancestors. That's an important part of my life, constantly thinking about and being informed by the energy of the ancestors and knowing that, you know, their love and resiliency is why we're here today, knowing what they went through, you know, and they kept on keeping on, and here we are. So I want to give that acknowledgement as well as, you know, wanting to be good ancestors ourselves and for those who are coming behind us. So I just like to center ourselves in that kind of energy. Yeah.
Thank you for doing that. I found our land acknowledgement was really long. So we're not going to read it, but we are on Chickasaw land here in Memphis.
Okay. Chickasaw.
Right along the mighty Mississippi.
So you are there in Memphis, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I love it. I love it. And the last time I was there, it was so wonderful to spend just a few hours on my way to the airport, right? And we had a chance to talk and break some bread.
It was a magical few hours, though.
It was. It was really beautiful. And I'm looking forward to coming back to Memphis. That was my first time in Memphis.
Really? And, yeah. It will not be your last. Yeah,
no, not at all. Mm-mm. Not at all. You know, and I have such a long history of music business in my bones, in my soul, yep. The work that I've done. And Memphis is such a center of music, and so Black music.
It is.
Yeah, yeah.
I often say that creativity is Memphis's number one natural resource.
Creativity. I love it. Mm-hmm. I love it. I love it. And I would say in Oakland, it's, it's like activism.
Yes.
It's our number one export.
Wokeness is the number one natural resource.
Exactly. Panthers. So I'm going to begin by, reading this incredible bio. Just bear with me. Bear with me. All right. Because we got to let folks know who you are and all how amazing you are. So I see that you, so in a sentence, I would say that Anasa is leveraging stories for social impact. Leveraging stories, and you have done so many things. So it begins with saying a cultural strategist, a writer, a producer, an entrepreneur. Anasa is committed to shifting global culture to a culture of care. And as president and CEO of the Big We, I love that, the Big We, Anasa and her team engage deeply in storytelling as a pathway to this transformation. And execute culture-based strategies for artists, organizations, and brands that are aligned with their vision of a just and loving world. Based in Memphis, Tennessee, Anasa has provided strategic and creative support in many important cultural, political, and social justice spaces, but is best known for her work as a strategic advisor and executive producer for the longtime friend an amazing badass artist, India Arie.
Yeah.
Yes. And Anasa's latest project is the restoration of the historic Claiborne Temple, the Memphis church that was the organizing headquarters of the sanitation worker strike of 1968, where Martin Luther King Jr.'s his last campaign. And you're transforming it into a center to build cultural, economic power with Memphis's African American community.
Amen. From your lips to God's ears.
Wow. I mean, you know, it goes from there's so many things you're good at and that you. I mean, honestly, it blows my mind. It's like, and I know that people also look at, you know, the things I've done and they go, what does this have to do with that? But I get it. I see.
I know you do.
It.
That's why I love you so yes. much, because all the things I do are all the things you do.
Yes. And I
you
see the connection.
Better.
No. Hey. Wait. Ho. Not true. Not true. Maybe been doing them a little longer because I'm older, but that's
bit.
About it. That's about bit. It. Mm-hmm. But you know, I always start my podcast off with this question. I don't have nothing to do with nothing that we just talked about. Okay. Here's the question. All right. So the Brown Rice Hour is called the Brown Rice Hour because brown rice was one of the most pivotal, when I got introduced to brown rice and started eating brown rice, it was one of the most pivotal times in my life. This is when I changed my entire life. I changed my diet. I did this whole macrobiotic movement was out then. This was in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
And the eating of brown rice became this incredible change in my life and my whole constitution and everything changed. And I was microbiotic for a while and the basis is brown rice. And it became this comfort food, this food that I just... And so brown rice for me is something that I still love today. But it was really a pivotal point for me as strange as that may sound. And so my first question, because I believe I love food, all right? And I think food tells a story. Food tells us, tells a story about a people.
I agree.
And I'm curious to ask you, what as a child was your favorite comfort food and who prepared it?
What an interesting question. You know, I don't remember my mother cooking a lot. Okay. We always talk about this. I basically learned how to cook from Martha Stewart and B. Smith when I was in college. And I know we ate, but I don't remember time in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. But I really loved two things when I was a child. One of them was blueberries.
Blueberries?
And the other thing was avocado. And my mother, they used to call me the blueberry monster, as a matter of fact. That's how much I love blueberries. And I just remember, you know, just eating raw, plain old blueberries or avocados.
Wow. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Jersey.
In New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I was a big fan of peanut butter and jelly. I will not lie. Mm-hmm. But if you were asking about comfort, like what my favorite things to go to, and I just was like, I just want to feel all juicy. Blueberries and avocados.
Blueberries and avocados.
For sure. To this day.
Well, that's interesting. Blueberry is absolutely my favorite berry. I have a ton of it and I freeze them. And I have about
3 gallons of wild blueberries in my freezer right now.
Right now. Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. I can dig it. And I put them in smoothies. You put them in smoothies?
I sure do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good. And you know what? Guess what?
What?
I have a garden out front, you know, like a lot of people, you know, what do you do during coronavirus?
You garden and bake.
Right. Garden and bake. I'm gardening, but I love to garden anyway, but someone gave us, my sister who I live with for her birthday this last month, blueberry plants.
No.
And I am growing 2 blueberry plants.
What?
Yes. And one of them so far is doing really good.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And that's awesome. I'm very excited. So as soon as the blueberries come, I am going to package up a little Ziploc bag.
I accept.
Sending it straight to Memphis.
I accept. You know, that's one of the reasons. I've been practicing indoor gardening. And like right now, I want to buy a house just so I can have a real garden outside. I'm like, the only reason I want to buy a house is for a garden and a real kitchen.
Yeah. Yeah. Garden and a real kitchen. I know there's nothing like food and fixing your own food and especially growing it and fixing it. I love it.
Different. It makes life feel different.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is.
I remember my mother's family were farmers.
Right.
And my mother grew up on a farm. And I remember my grandfather, when he lived in Springfield, Massachusetts, in the later end of his life, going to his house and going in his garden and just picking fruit and vegetables, just eating right off the vine. And then we lived in Charleston for a little while when I was a kid. And my mother had a humongous garden.
Oh, wow. All right.
Humongous garden growing up.
And all vegetables and fruit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And just feels like something you're supposed to do.
We are supposed to.
Yeah.
We are supposed to. I'm out there growing a lot of food right now.
It's awesome.
It's great. It's great. There's nothing like it. And so
one day
it's coming.
I've been looking for like a big old plot of land for probably a year.
In Memphis?
When I decided I was going to stay here, because, you know, I was supposed to be here for 6 months.
Right.
But after I decided I was going to stay, I'm like, I need to find some land.
Okay.
I need to figure this out.
You're looking for some land right now in Memphis, in the Memphis area.
Yeah. Memphis, northern Mississippi, you know. Around there. I have this, like, if you ask anybody in my family, like, what's my ultimate goal, they'll tell you the compound. Everybody knows it.
The compound.
I've been talking about it for years and years and years because when I was in my, I guess, late 20s, early 30s, I was really, really keen on living in an intentional community.
Yeah. Beautiful.
And I traveled around looking for one. Like, I was serious. I was doing it. And I literally never met one other Black person at any of the places that I met and visited.
Yeah.
And in some places, it was like so bad that I knew that I was going to become a novelty. I would be like, oh, we got a Black one. You know?
just driving right in. Didn't even have to go find her. She just showed up.
We got one. Yay. And I was like, yeah, no, I'm not. No, thank you. Because it doesn't feel like that doesn't feel like community to me.
No.
And it also doesn't feel like the kind of community that I want to live in. Because for me, the whole point of intentional community is practicing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For the future. Like practicing the world that we want to.
That's right.
That we want everybody to live in. And the world that I want everybody to live in is not the world where there's one Black woman who's a novelty. That's not the world.
No.
So I have been like hell bent on building this community for years at this point. So much so that my family knows that like it's coming, and when it doesn't need to pack their stuff and let's go. So maybe it's gonna be here.
Is there room for another little Black girl to come show up at the at the compound?
There is nowhere that I am that you can't go.
Well, let me tell you something, my dear. I too have had an ongoing deep desire to live in an intentional community.
Have you?
Yes, I have. Whoa. And it's I was just talking about it just the other day to some friends, and it's very interesting that we need to talk offline about this, because I really am very interested, and I've been wanting to do it for a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, the parameters of it, like, you know, what I want to do is get out of Americans say they want to do certain things that sound collective, but when you boil down to it, if it ain't about, you know, no, right? Mm-hmm. Because we have this me mentality that is not collaborative, that it's is not culture. It's our culture. And so it's like, how do we get through that barrier that stops us? And so I am really interested in that, because I honestly, I would love nothing more in life than to live in an intentional community. Nothing more.
I think it's the only way to get to where we want to go.
Yeah.
Because everything that all these things that we talk about, they're totally in theory.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, because even the most whatever of us, we still live a normal American life. We just do. And in order for us to get to the point where we can invite people into larger and larger community, then we have to actually start somewhere. And that's for me why. I mean, the only way for any of us to be able to have that life is to be able to do it together.
That's right.
Because when you're doing it by yourself, you're not doing it.
You're not doing it.
And I think it's going to be hard, but it's going to be, you know, beautiful. And just think about, you know, what it means to have like actual community, and what that would be like for the children to grow up in the place like that. I just think about my niece and nephew and what it would be like for them to grow up in a place where they were 20 houses and they can knock on any one of the doors, or just, you know what I mean?
Be
cared for and experience all kind of wonderful things, and big community dinners on Thursday nights.
That's right.
You know, that's movies outside and ponds and all. I mean, that's just all the things.
I love it. Right.
All the things.
Area, yoga area, garden. All that.
I have a whole design in my mind, Conda. Like, I've been taking this down the road. Okay.
So let's talk about it and let's figure it out, because I swear I am serious.
You heard it here first, folks, on the Brown Rice Hour.
Y'all heard it. Brown Rice Hour. You heard it.
We're doing it.
And you know, this brings me to an interesting question that I wanted to talk to you about too.
Yeah.
And it has to do with, in your bio, you talked about shifting global culture to a culture of care.
Yes.
And I really want to talk about this culture of care, you know, because I think I feel like we, and again, going back to the American culture of separation, is that we have defined our who we care about so narrowly, right? Because it's either me or, you know, at my family, and that's usually just my nuclear family, because cousins and granny and all them don't necessarily fit into it, right? And a few friends can come in, you know, but basically we have this culture that is, I think of it as this culture of me, and that there's this filter that I think that one of the first filters that happens in our minds is like, In general, like, for example, there's so many things trying to get your attention, right? For when you're going down the street, just billboards or ads online, everybody's trying to get your attention. Hmm. And there's this filter that we have, this natural filter that says, what's it got to do with me? Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I could see something about, you know, owning a boat or whatever. What's that got to do with me? Yeah. Right. And so we start to narrow down to what's it got to do with me. And then we find something. Oh, okay. Now this little area has to do with me.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that I'm curious about, and I want to have a conversation with you about what has happened here across the planet, across the globe, around the murder of George Floyd. Okay. Where the entire world has shown care and has been impacted. Mm-hmm. And it's like something happened that allowed that horrible murder to jump over this filter of what's it got to do with me. And people seem to have widened their definition of me. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe they have widened their definition of me. Maybe that's what's happening. How did that happen? Why did that happen? And one of the things I think about is that the coronavirus has tenderized everybody, right? Like, it's, we're wearing it on our skin, and and we're rooting for life. We're rooting for life in this time of coronavirus. We're rooting for care for our life, for others' lives. And then this heinous, outrageous thing happens.
Yeah.
But I do think that I'm hopeful. And maybe, you know, I'm the glasses half full kind of girl.
Me too.
Is it that, I'd love to get your take on it, that do you think that perhaps the definition of me and care has widened? Or do you think it's just an anomaly? Tell the truth.
So this is, oh boy, I'm always out myself. I always, out myself as an esoteric kooky lady. So, so I think a couple things are true.
Okay.
The reason why I am optimistic and that I'm a glasses half full kind of girl is because I believe that the spiritual evolution of humanity is inevitable. I think it's happening all the time.
Okay.
Because I think the reason why humans come down to the planet Earth is for our souls to learn and grow and evolve. So if we are here, then we are opening up, we're blossoming as just beings.
Just from being here.
And the more humans come to Earth and the more time we spend inhabiting this planet, the further humanity goes down that road of ascendance, if you will.
So the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
I absolutely believe that that's true.
Okay.
I really, really do.
I do too.
And I think it I think it bends more towards than just justice. I think it bends towards joy. I think it bends towards love. I think it bends towards community. And justice too. Because if you have all those things, then you have justice. So yeah, I do think that.
Okay.
I also think, God bless them, this president that we have, I think, has also really contributed to people being like, wait a minute.
Wait a minute.
This can't be right. This can't be.
This is a little extreme.
It's terrible to laugh about that. It's terrible. But I think so. I think that, like, I think that people are awakening to the possibility that some of the things that we've been saying are true for the last whatever our lifetime are true, right?
Who's we've been saying, you're talking about black
people. Funny. I literally meant we, like me and you, literally meant that. But I also mean black people. I mean women. I mean people who are concerned with humanity.
Yeah.
People who are maybe a little bit further down that road of awakening, who are really thinking about how to care for each other in a different kind of, in a more robust, more holistic way.
Yeah.
I think that people who are fighting for justice, people who are, you know, people who are I'm fighting for the least of these. Mm-hmm. All those, that whole list of people have been saying, like, wow, y'all, this isn't working.
Right. Not
and
working.
The majority of people have been like, it's totally working. What it's are you working talking for me. About? It's working for me. Right.
Working for me.
And now mm-hmm. I think even the people for whom it is working are starting to see, oh crap, it really is not working for them. It really is not. And it's not okay. And it's not, and it's not just because they're lazy or because they're whatever. It's like, whoa, like this dude is really, whoa. Right. And to put a face and a personality on the punitive nature of America and American culture on communities that have been underestimated and under-resourced and underserved and in some cases just flat out beat down has been, I think, another step. Like that's step two. Like step one was like, we're humans and we're growing. Step two was like, whoa, this dude is putting a microscope on what it looks like for people to be systematically oppressed.
Yeah.
Violated.
Yeah.
All those things. And I do think the coronavirus, what coronavirus did was two things. I think one, I think it did three things. I love that you said that we want to live, like we're looking for life. That's so beautiful because I never considered that language, but I think that that's true. People are afraid and they're looking for signs of life.
Yeah.
I also think that that coronavirus had us spend 2 months listening to the news talking about how Black and Brown people are dying faster, more.
Yeah.
Right. Faster, more and higher numbers.
Yeah.
Talking about, you know, pre-existing conditions and the socioeconomic root of those pre-existing conditions.
Right.
And like America is more acutely aware and educated about poverty and racism and what that has done to the conditions of Black America to the point where we're dying faster. Right. And in higher numbers. The other thing that coronavirus did was have everybody sit on their butts at home for 3 months.
That's right.
And those of us that have a contemplative practice understand the power of silence and stillness.
That's right.
And the whole world, the whole entire world has been still since March.
Quiet.
At least.
Quiet.
Right? And so, like, I think the combination of those things set the stage for us to watch collectively George Floyd be murdered. And I think it wasn't just those things, but it was also the nature of his murder. Because what we have seen in the past from police murders of Black men and women had been really violent. They've been like kinetic, like moving around and rustling and there's been like very struggly but we literally saw this man was like so casual about it. It was
hands in his pockets.
It was like he was literally kneeling on the grass at the park. It was like there was no argument to be made about, oh well, if he had just not resisted arrest, oh, if he had not done this thing. Oh, if he had not been running. Oh, if he had just followed orders. There was no space for all of the arguments that people always make about why someone, quote unquote, deserved to be murdered by the police or why they could have avoided or why it was their fault. There was no, there was nothing anyone could have said because the man legit looked like he was out to tea. Like it was just like, And I know that people are having a hard time right now. I know that people are feeling destabilized by the coronavirus and by the response to George Floyd's murder. But I am actually pretty damn excited about it because I feel like
silver lining.
Finally, y'all, we're having a whole conversation.
Right. Finally.
Finally.
Finally. In
people
America.
Are saying, like, white people are like, oh, wait, oh, racism is real.
Right. Something's wrong.
Yes.
Something's really wrong.
And do you know how many Black friends I have had conversations with who have been like, whoa, I was asleep at the wheel because I've been mimicking white male behavior my entire career to make it in corporate America. And now I realize it's time for me to wake up.
See.
And those have been the most powerful conversations I've had.
See.
Yeah. It's been amazing.
Yeah. Well, you know, the role of white supremacy that has infiltrated everything is in all of us. It's like the white supremacist in me.
Yep. That's right.
Has moments when I go, oh, check myself.
That's right.
Right. And so this is not just, you know, it affects white people. It is all of us,
everybody.
And we have tried so hard to mimic that which is actually killing us.
That's right.
The lack of sacredness is what I always point to. You know, we don't have anything that's sacred.
No.
That is at the bottom of a mentality and ideology that has wiped out sacredness.
Yeah.
And so you can do anything, right?
Literally.
You can literally do anything because there's no moral foundation around what is sacred and what then that leaves everything available to you to do. And whether it's destroying that tree over there or whatever it might be. Yeah. All of it. And so, we are all following that model.
Yeah.
And I have to say that, you know, Black and brown folks are not exempt from that. And it's very interesting. I'd love to hear or be a fly on the wall in those conversations you have with Black. I haven't had any, but I have a warning that I've been giving us.
It's coming.
I've been, yeah.
Exactly. The other thing that's been super interesting because, you know, white supremacy is derivative of patriarchy.
Right.
So I have also been having a lot of conversations with men about as many with men as I have about with white people about like, no, this is not the time for us to just be like, we need to focus on race and we'll talk about gender. Right.
No. That's right. Let's get down to the problem.
Don't do it. We're not doing that. And it's been really, the resistance I've gotten in those conversations is more than the resistance I've gotten in conversations about race.
Is that with men of color?
Yeah.
Not one to be a part of the problem.
Yeah. It's a beautiful time to be alive. It is an amazing time.
It's an amazing time.
Really hard, but very, very rich.
It is. And why I think one of the reasons why it's so rich is that Black women, let's just say it, are leading the way.
Yeah.
Black women are absolutely leading the way.
I mean, we're uniquely positioned to do that.
Yeah, we are.
You know, and the truth is, I mean, my truth, the thing that I think is true is that what is happening right now is, you know, as we talk about the evolution of humanity, it's time for the rise of the divine feminine. In order for divine feminine to live and be robustly in the forefront, then patriarchy and white supremacy have to die.
They have to die.
That is where we are. And if you want to talk about the embodiment of the divine feminine and that sacred that you were talking about, that's Black women.
It is. And I think that there's just this natural movement, as you said. I love what you first said about this experiment called humanity on the planet, where we've come here to just evolve and to go through all this stuff and to figure out, get over these obstacles, exactly, a school. We all in school. And for that natural evolution, right now, what is rising, seeing Black women rising in this natural evolution.
Yeah.
Okay, when I look at, you know, the movement for Black lives, when I think about all the sisters that are in the lead, and not only sisters, but queer sisters as well.
That's right.
Okay, let's
talk
about that. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about it. And that this is the moment that is just this leaderful movement that is rising is impeccable. And I am loving watching this happen.
Me too.
I gotta say, I'm loving it.
I'm like, finally, something I can get behind. Yes. Come on, y'all. Let's go.
But you know, one of the things that comes to me is when I think about this upcoming election in November.
Child. Are we talking about this election?
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to go there. Because here's the deal. Here's the deal. White women.
God bless them.
God bless them. And my dearest friends, honestly, mm-hmm. have put this man in the White House. And we know mm-hmm. that.
Yeah.
So it's like, what you going to do now?
Will they keep him there? Is the question.
Will they keep him there? Mm-hmm. And what does it take for Black women and white women to understand, to get over our huge divide that we have? Mm. Okay. Right. Can we? Well, you're again, glass is half full. So you're going to say, yes, it's possible. But what will it take for that? For Black women and white women to actually, and women of color and white women, and understand each other in a way that we are working towards the divine femininity.
So I believe that what is required for Black women and white women to be able to work together for that is for white women to reconcile their relationship, their historic relationships in the slave economy mm-hmm. with their husbands, mm-hmm. their mm-hmm. slave owning, land owning husbands, mm-hmm. and the role that they played in the home, the role mm-hmm. that they played in the terror, mm-hmm. and also yeah. the pain of mm-hmm. not being able to live in their own full humanity.
Right.
Right? Like, what right. is it like to be a woman who is married with children and know that your husband is out raping women every night?
That's right. And you see, and I'm so happy you said this, because I have the theory as well that white women who were white, obviously, mm-hmm. but very disempowered as women. Very disempowered.
Very.
You know, the man owned the land mm-hmm. and the plantation.
Even if it was their daddy's land.
Even though it was their daddy's land, they didn't own it. That's right. Mm-hmm. And then you walk around and suddenly you see these mixed race babies on the plantation.
You know them, your husband's babies. You know good and well. You know.
Mm-hmm. You know. And so what you do, because you have no power with the mm-hmm. husband, you take it out on the Black house slave, female house slave.
Yeah.
Right. And that schism and that whole historical harm is playing out, I think, right now.
And not only do you take out your pain and your disillusionment mm-hmm. on the folks who you feel like you have power over, who in this case are Black people, Black men and women, mm-hmm. but you also double down on your commitment to your white husband, your white land-owning, slave-owning husband.
Right.
Because you have to, you feel like you have to, because if you don't, what are you going to do?
Where are you?
And so you can't like the cognitive dissonance of this is evil, but I have to stay here.
Right.
It's too much. So you go, this is right. And I get to stay here, and I want to participate as robustly as I possibly can.
That's right.
And that is why white women voted for Donald Trump, because white women have historically in America been trained to support mm-hmm. and endear themselves to their husband's socioeconomic political whims for their own spiritual survival.
Yeah.
Because to look at their husband's face and say, what you're doing is wrong and I'm going to say something, is too much for them.
Yeah.
It was too much.
Yeah.
And they are going to have to deal with the pain of that in order for them to be able to say, I want to be in this group of people who are willing to fight for the freedom of all people and the liberation of our souls. And until and unless that happens, it doesn't matter how many workshops we have. It doesn't matter.
You know, you're so right. And I feel exactly the same way. And I keep thinking to you know, kind of put a light underneath it and push it forward quicker. Mm-hmm. I don't see them doing that themselves to that level. They have women's circles. They don't have this conversation.
I've literally never
heard analysis. Not this analysis.
Even the white women who I trust the most and work with the most.
Yeah.
That's not their conversation. Their conversation is not about healing their own relationship Mm-mm. with slavery and slave ownership and their husbands and the patriarchy. Now, that's not, I've never heard not one of them say that.
Never.
Their thing is about like humanity and, you know, like all that, which is beautiful.
Yeah, but they skipped over the deeper level.
You skipped over your own healing that's required for you to be in it for real and for you to invite your sisters in a way that is actually healing and resonant for them. Because people who don't have the context around humanity, because everybody doesn't have that, like, we should fight for everyone. Everybody don't have that. No. So, like, for the people who need to face their own pain and the their own DNA and spiritual legacy of slavery as you know, in the lineage of white women, that's not I literally have never heard anyone else say that.
So let me ask you a question. So we've identified that that is what's necessary, that internal healing for white women to have that analysis and to do the work in order for it to, for us to, you know, get any further down the road together. We also agree that that's not coming from them.
No, ma'am.
We know it's coming from us.
Yeah.
Now let me ask you something. As tired as we get of leading the way.
Yes.
Is there any energy towards leading the way for white women to see that?
Yeah. I mean, I actually don't, I don't think that this is everybody's work, but I don't get tired about that.
Good.
I don't get weary of talking to white people about white people stuff. I don't. I'm like, let's talk about it. Let's go. Let's talk about it.
right.
What I do, what I have done recently is to have, which is really not just about that, but really about my work in general, my life in general, is about what infrastructures and support is required for me to do this work and do it sustainably and in a healthy way for me.
Right.
So I don't have to then untangle myself at the end of the day, and be on the pile on the floor because that's what I've done in the past.
How do you take care of yourself?
And the other thing is, like, so many of the white women who I feel really connected to are saying to me, like, do not do this by yourself. Like, we are here. Like, we are here. Allow us to step into that space with you. Use us to be able to do whatever work we need to do in that space. And I, it's funny because I never even thought that that was a thing, because I just, there's so few people who are willing to do that. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't.
For me, having those conversations is actually, I think, part of my work, because I know there are so few people who are willing and able to hold it, I can hold it.
You can hold it. I can hold it too. I love that.
Hold it.
And you know, it goes back to me to this word ally, which I don't like. I don't like the word ally. I don't like it.
I don't use it. I'm like, don't tell me you're trying to help me, girl. You better help yourself.
That's right. Ally is like, this is your problem and I'm going to come and help you.
No, ma'am.
And that is not the, but see, in my, I love the idea of partnering. So if we got rid of the word ally, because ally assumes like you're coming to help me do something that's my problem. Okay. Yep. But if we change the word to partner, then we both have issues.
Yeah.
Right. We both. Yep. Are bought in, and now we can have this conversation as a partner.
Yeah.
We can have the conversation that I need to have with you. You can have the conversation you need to have with me. Yeah. And nobody's ally to anybody, because the ally already puts into place a power structure that is not true. Yeah. And it continues to center white power.
That's right.
So we get rid of ally.
Yeah.
We become partners with white women.
Yeah.
Now we have a playing field where we can bring about the kind of healing that everybody needs. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think it's funny because if anybody needs an ally, it's white women. You actually need our allyship and support in your
absolutely.
So that you can show up as a full partner.
That's right.
But yeah, there's three words I do not use. That most people in the, lots of folks use when they're talking about race and class. One of them is ally. I do not use that word. And anybody says it to me, I correct them. And I say, that's not something I'm interested in.
Me too.
The other word is minority.
Oh, gosh.
I was raised to not, like my father, the two words that I grew up not being able to say was the N word and the M word. Like, we do not say minority in our house. My father would say, that is a word that was meant to diminish us. We do not talk about ourselves that way. So I don't use that word.
Love your parents.
I don't use people of color.
Right.
And I'm like, don't erase me. Right. Don't center me in my lack of whiteness.
Right.
The least you could do is go on and say, Indigenous, Black, Latinx, Asian, API, whatever, like that. Which even those four or five things is not enough to talk about the robustness of my identity and my culture. But that at least let's start there. Like, I don't, I do not want to be defined by my lack of whiteness. That's just as bad as.
Right. It's centering whiteness. POC centers whiteness.
Still, like, why are we still centering white people?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you know,
Liberation Vocabulary 101, folks. Take some things out your vocabulary today.
I think that was a good lesson already. I mean, we can close the book now and say, you know, this is done, because that right there, those three lessons are enough. So that was no allies, no minorities, no people of color. Okay, done. Done.
Not on the brown rice hour, honey.
Not on the brown rice hour. We don't do that. Oh, I love you so much, girl. You are really
you.
You know, I think about all that you've done and all that, and you imbue everything with this Anasa-ism. You know, this Anasa-ism is just like, if you can't help yourself, it's all pervasive.
I just stopped trying. I was like, bump it.
No. Don't even stop. I mean, it's like, I think about, like I said, when I started out, I think about, people want to see a linear line go across your life. Oh, you started here, and then you did this, and you did this, and this, and it all makes sense.
Over here.
They don't do that, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was the first time I met you, and I heard, because I didn't even, like, oddly enough, I didn't even meet you through the social justice. I met you because we have a mutual friend from music industry, Suzanne Koga.
That's right.
So when I met you and I heard your story, I was like, there's another me on the planet. Someone understands me.
And we're going to live in an intentional community too. Don't forget that.
Yes. And that's why I will always show up for you, because I feel like you showing up for you is showing up for myself.
Yeah.
Because you are the only person literally that I've ever met in my whole entire life whose path.
Yeah.
Mirrors mine. And if I say anything to you at all, you are going to understand what I'm talking about. You will not look at me funny. You will not cock your head to the side. You will not ask for explanation. You'll be like, I got you.
And vice versa.
And that it's, is like,
it's rare. I mean, when it we is. Met, yeah. And I saw, our parallel paths, literally.
Crazy.
But not only just the things we do,
the people
but how we do it and what's underneath
it.
That's because you know what it is.
That's
let me tell you what it is, Anasa.
Tell me.
I think it has a lot to do with the fact that I know how I grew up and how you grew up. I grew up loved.
Yes, me too.
And you grew up loved.
100%.
Your family loved you. My family loved me.
Mm-hmm.
I never, ever, ever, ever questioned that. It was we were surrounded by love and the possibility to do anything you can and you want to in the world.
Yes.
That's the story I was told. That's the story you were told.
That foundation
makes a huge, especially as Black women in America.
That's right.
Because the story out there that's coming feeding back to you is just the opposite.
Right. That's right. And I always have that story that my parents told me to lean on when people try to tell me something different, and I don't have to listen to them. And it's funny because my parents will call me and be like, "We're so proud you did this thing, you did that thing." I'm like, "I learned it from y'all. What are you talking about?" Because my parents have similar lives. My parents like started off in education. My mother was an English teacher. My dad had a degree in gym education, like physical education.
Mm-hmm.
And then my parents went to professional school when I was 3 years old. My mother went to law school. My dad went to medical school. Then my father got into public health. And my mother was a deputy attorney general. But they were also dancers and drummers and advocates. And my mother was a lay leader at the church house. It was like, I am doing all the things that y'all did. It just looks different because, you know, because it's me.
Yeah.
But my parents definitely always told me that I could literally, they would say, you can do anything.
Yep.
And I believed them. And, you know,
clearly you did.
I mean, the other thing is because my father was a doctor, my mom was a lawyer. When I was in middle school and people would say, what are you going to be when you grow up? They would not say, what are you going to be? They would say, are you going to be a doctor or a lawyer?
Right. Right. No and question.
For a black girl, for those to be her two options. And I would be mad, like, I don't have to do either one. Like, how dare you put me in a box? Because I didn't know that black women didn't get to do that. I didn't know that you were supposed to be a teacher or a librarian. I didn't
That's
know.
Right. That's
I didn't
right.
know.
And
so I never thought to do anything except for what my soul asked me to do. So yeah.
And you followed that. You always followed that. And you ended up in this place of culture, of deep culture.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that.
Too.
And I was supposed to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
And I didn't do that. I ended up in deep culture.
Because you weren't supposed to be a lawyer.
Because I wasn't supposed to be a lawyer.
And that was the whole point in my house was culture. My parents, the reason my name is Anasa is because my parents were trying to build a West African cultural framework for me and my sister so we would know that who we were was dope, no matter what.
Right.
That's all they were doing. And so it just, the thing that is interesting to me though, like the thing that I'm asking myself, because what they also did was weave this story for me about justice, which means they're weaving a story about injustice, right? So
right.
The thing I don't know is who I would be if I wasn't making myself responsible for untangling race, class, and gender. Like if I just was like, I could do any, right. If I was actually free, not free of white people, not free of race, not free of nothing, but just free,
just
period.
Free. Right.
What would I be doing? And that is my discovery right now. That is what I'm asking myself right now. It's like, well, what if you didn't have to think about that?
Right.
What if you didn't have to think about
right.
that? Right. What would you do?
See, that's a deep question. And, you know, I always find myself in situations like, for example, I'm on a board and I'm on a lot of boards, too many boards. But this one particular board is like, you know, I find myself. Like I'm on the board because I've got a lot of ideas,
right? Of course.
I've got a lot that I could add.
Of course.
But I spend 99% of my time not adding to the vision, but stomping out the madness around race and patriarchy and all that.
Yeah.
And so now my voice, like that's who Conda
is. That's who you are.
That's who I am on that board. When I can't even get to why I really want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Because all this I'm battling and showing up because I can't not do it. Yep. I can't not let something go by and not, I can't, right? And so I spend that. And so that becomes my identity versus all this richness that I have to add.
The actual identity, which is creative genius.
That's right. And I can't get to it. And I can't get to it. So it's like, that's the question that you're asking. Like, what if none of that was there and we had the ability to not deal with that, but to just bring our creative juices? Can you imagine?
I mean, that's why I started the Big We.
The Big We. Let's talk about the Big We.
Was really like the mechanism I wanted to create to answer the question of who would I be if I was free?
Mm.
And I'm, you know, it's an experiment, so I'm not saying I'm free. I'm saying I got a thing to help me get free.
Girl, do you even know what does freedom look like? Like, what is it?
Who the hell knows? I do not know.
Like,
I
don't know what it looks like.
I don't know what it looks like or feels like or anything, but I assume that when I get there, I'll know. Or I assume that the pursuit of it is worth
Maybe it's not a goal.
Maybe
it's not a goal. Maybe it's just the path, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Because the inquiry alone is transformative.
Right. Just oh my God.
Actually, I want to be free in real life. And what does that mean? It's life-changing. It's a life-changing conversation to be having.
So I got to tell you something. I feel really bad that I haven't been invited to the big wee, honey. You know I need to be invited, right?
Come on now. Yes, you can be invited.
Come on now.
Come on.
Right? All right.
Oh my God, that would be so good.
Can I knock on the big wee door? And because I want to be free.
Listen, you are more than welcome to come to the big wee. That would be so dope. Yes, you're invited. Let's figure it out.
Okay, let's figure it out.
What a good idea.
The big wee. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so is that a group of women? Is it
no? Women? So it started
is it
off
anybody?
No, it started off as a podcast. We started the podcast maybe we're on season 3 right now. So we started the podcast maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Okay.
And I realized that I'm like, wait, I've been spending my whole life building cultural strategies for other people and no one's doing what I think they should do. Why don't I just do it my own self?
Right, right.
And so I started the work of taking the podcast and expanding it from a podcast to a media platform and then building all these interventions and engagements based on the stories that we were telling. And so we still have the podcast, but now I'm writing a book and we're talking about filming TV and we're talking about like all the different ways that we can tell graphic novels. Like, what are the stories that we want to tell that embody the world that we want to live in? Like, what are our stories of being free for real?
Right. Right.
And then how do we engage people in those stories in such a way that they can then go and practice that freedom in their real lives?
I love it.
Which is like part of this reason why I'm in Memphis and why I'm doing the work at Claiborne and how the work at Claiborne is really inspiring me to do more of that work across the South. So it's like, why I don't want to just tell stories to inspire people. I want to tell stories and inspire people and then invest in them so those inspirations can come to life.
Good.
You know what I'm saying?
Because beautiful.
Too many of us are telling stories to do like the quote unquote narrative shift and then we leave it at that. And there's no way for people to practice being the way that we're asking them to be in our stories. And the big we is really for anyone who wants to tell a story of liberation.
You're so badass. Yes. I love you. You are just amazing. Anasa Trotman. Oh my God. And we haven't even gotten to Claiborne Temple and you as a developer.
Isn't that crazy?
That's so crazy.
That is so crazy.
You're a developer.
I thought I'd be a developer.
So Claiborne Temple. Mm-hmm. You want to tell me a little bit, tell the audience a little bit about what that is and how that happened and what you're doing?
Yeah. So I came
and the importance to of that place of that historical.
Yeah. So I came to Memphis because I have a girls program and I was I had a funder here and someone was like, you should go by Claiborne Temple. And I'm like, I don't know what that is. Okay, I'll go. And I go by and I open the door and like walk in and my whole brain exploded with all these colors and stories and voices and I'm like, what have I just walked into? What is this place?
Juiciness.
Turns out it is the historic organizing headquarters for the sanitation workers strike of 1968, which your listeners would know if they know those iconic I Am a Man signs. Those signs came from this movement. And it was the last campaign that Martin Luther King did before he was assassinated. And in fact, he was assassinated 0.4 miles down the road from Historic Claiborne Temple at the hotel, at the Lorraine Motel.
Right.
And so the interesting thing about the building, I can talk about this for 4 hours. So I'm going to do this super short version.
Exactly. Right.
Because this building is one of the most beautiful spaces I've ever been in, but it also, to me, is the embodiment of the story of race, class, and militarism in America, right? And if you listen to King's speech that he made a year to the day before he died, April 4th, 1967, at Riverside Church, the Beyond Vietnam speech.
Yep, yep.
Where he said, like, the work we've done around race is really powerful, but if we really want to have a free country, we have to do the work of the intersection of race, class, and militarism.
That's right.
And the reason why he came to Memphis to work with the sanitation workers is because he saw that work being exemplified in Memphis, and he was mm-hmm. having a hard time convincing people that that was the right thing to do, because mm-hmm. they were like, you are messing us up. We're right. losing donors. Right. We need to focus on race. Like, stop talking about all this other stuff. We don't need That's to right. have a multiracial low, like, poverty. Poverty, what? No. We're talking about Black people. Stay focused and keep it moving. And so he was like, if I go to Memphis and I help them make this work, then I can show people what I mean and have a way to be able to take this conversation to scale across the country. And he was planning the Poor People's Campaign, right? So
that's right.
So the work of the sanitation worker strike that was happening at Claiborne Temple was to be his MVP for the Poor People's Campaign. He was like, this is my proof of concept. Mm-hmm. I can make this work. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. when I started to, like, really research, oh, right. So I eventually started working with the guys who owned the building and was commissioned to co-write and produce a musical about the sanitation worker strike for the 50th anniversary of King's assassination. That's how I got involved with them.
Okay.
So I'm researching, reading all these things, watching movies, talking to people. And I read the story about the first African-American millionaire mm-hmm. named Robert Church mm-hmm. and how he was a slave. He was a mixed race enslaved African whose father was his master. But we talked about this earlier, and whose father was also his officer in the Confederate Army.
Oh.
Right. It's a whole very convoluted thing. So there's this whole thing. Civil War comes, Union Army comes, the Union Navy, because they're on the Mississippi River, okay. having, like, straight up war battles on the Mississippi, right?
Right.
And the Union Navy comes, and Robert Church is like, this is my chance. I can go. And mm-hmm. the story is that he jumps ship off of mm-hmm. his dad's ship mm-hmm. and he swims to the shore and he frees himself and he ends up making this whole fortune in real estate mm-hmm. in downtown Memphis. It's a very
really
it's an amazing story.
Wow.
But the point
that's
is
the movie, like, right there.
It's I want to write his movie so bad.
Yeah, that's a
my
movie.
God. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, like, he has this whole thing. There's, like, yellow fever plague. Like, half of Memphis dies or leaves. Mm-hmm. He saves the city by buying the first municipal bond. He has all this land. He grows his empire more. He's the founder of Beale Street. Founder of Beale Street. The supporter of W.C. Handy. The supporter of Ida B. Wells. Like, all the work that she did in Memphis. He paid for all of it. Like, his story, right? And then the second generation, his son. His son is Robert Church Jr. Mary Church Terrell, if you heard that name, is his daughter. So, like, his kids are, like, very active in politics as Black wow. people in the turn wow. of the century, right?
Wow.
So his son is like, my dad built, you know, financial wealth for Black people. I'm gonna build political wealth for us. And he goes to this whole thing, gets in bed with the white power politicians in Memphis. They eventually seize all his land. Mm-hmm. And then burn his father's house to the ground. Mm-hmm. And what I realized, because coincidentally, this all happens around the corner from historic Claiborne Temple.
Okay.
And what I realized is that the history of Claiborne Temple and the history of Memphis mm-hmm. from the beginning, mm-hmm. right, from the day that man jumped ship, is right, is this continuum. Like, the mayor in 1968 is the mayor in the 1800s that was right. It's like this whole consistent story of the work of Black folks to build this mm-hmm. power mm-hmm. and sovereignty mm-hmm. and the white power structure doing their best to destroy it, right? And even to today. And right. I was like, this story's not about the sanitation workers at all. this my work here is not about this one moment. Just like I need to stay here and I need to help restore the legacy of the sanitation workers, but also Robert Church and Mary Church Farrell and Ida B. Wells and Cornelia Crenshaw and all of them, Reverend Lawson. I'm like, these are the people whose stories that I need to hold. A retail and then animate for people because so that they can practice in the 21st century. And so Claiborne Temple, like there's a whole dramatic story about how I wrestled with, not really, but like wrestled with the owner, had a really terrible, nasty power struggle with this older white man, Christian evangelical, who looked at me in my face and said, no one's ever going to give you money. You can't do this. You might as well just stop. And how I raised this money and bought this building from him, right? That's a whole another 2 hours.
But the end result is that you raised the money and you
raised the money.
You bought the building.
We got the building.
So you got the building.
We now are like, we're doing this restorative economy work, restorative development. We're telling stories and we're inviting people in, and we're like, oh, this is not just a Memphis story. This is an international conversation like the sovereignty of Black wealth, the sovereignty of Black culture and our stories and the impact that we have on the planet.
Anasa Troutman, I'm telling you. I mean, you just passing through and now you own Claiborne Temple. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's that going back to the beginning of the conversation that you said, this evolutionary impulse. I think of it as an evolutionary impulse that is alive and well, that we are being animated through, making choices along the way, but completely animating our lives.
I think even back further to the beginning of our conversation, when you're like acknowledging the land and acknowledging our ancestors, I honestly think that the souls who are living in and attached to Claiborne Temple asked me to do this work. Like Black people who toiled, you know, like all the names I mentioned, all of the sanitation workers, all the, you know, people whose names we will never know. I don't think that they were pleased with what was happening. And they were looking for someone to liberate that space and give it back to Black people, right? And I think the conversation that we've been having, not just about Black folks, but like, how do we reconcile the conversation that even in ownership of a space that became a Black sacred space is really Indigenous sacred land.
That's right.
And how are we supposed to, how do we have that conversation? Because you can't be like, well, no one should own it because then someone else will, right?
And
So really this, like all the wrestling that we're doing.
That is so at the core of the conversation of land.
It is. It's like.
At the conversation of land is stewardship and ownership because we don't own it. And yet if you don't own it, you know who's going to own it.
It's going to be developed.
It's going to, that's right. So you got to own it and steward it. Yeah. And it's like that combination of ownership and stewardship is what you're doing.
It's a difficult and really juicy place to be.
And you know what you said is that, and this is what I really believe is happening right now on this planet. And it always has, but it's just heightened now. And it has to do with our ancestors. And that is why I always begin with that, because I do believe that. The intensity of what's going on right now and our response to this, to this virus, and I'm not talking about the coronavirus. I'm talking about the virus of humanity's lack of sacredness and destroying everything in its, in its way. I believe that there is a direct speaking to of our ancestors are driving us to do the work that we're doing right now. I feel it so strongly, Anasa. I feel it so strongly. I know that the many, many millions and millions and millions of hours that they toiled, all right, and all everything that happened, that those hours that they never got paid, that they have been banked as time.
You know what? You just said something.
They have been banked as time, and we are stepping into this time zone where that's where the energy is, and it's moving us forward. That is what I really believe.
Whoa.
That's what I believe. And that's and it's not just for Black folks. I'm talking white folks, all of us. You know, white folks have lost the connection to even claiming ancestry. We all have ancestors.
I keep telling these people, I don't care who you got ancestors. Ancestors, everybody has indigenous wisdom because we all are have from indigenous. Somewhere.
That's right. We all have indigenous wisdom, mm-hmm. and the buying into, you know, what whiteness has brought to to folks. It was like at the cost of what? Of losing and walking away from the ancestors.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing that we at least have held on to. And it is the motivating and driving, animating factor.
Yeah.
That I think is playing out right now. So I love that you said that, you know, you're going to Claiborne Temple and knowing that there's a deep reason why I'm here.
Yeah.
And just saying yes. And that's the thing about you, Anasa, is that you say yes.
Yes, I do.
You say yes. And it comes again back to your parents and to how you were raised and loved and saying you are a yes person on this planet.
That is so beautiful.
That's who you are. Honestly.
That's awesome. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah. And that's awesome. Why I see you so deeply and resonate so deeply. And I'm so, I always say I'm proud of you. I'm just proud of you and all the work that you're doing in community and for the world and for all people, and that you still have that love and desire and patience and to work with everyone and say, let's do this together, because our liberation is tied.
That's right.
Our liberation is tied. I'm not going to get out of this without you.
Nope.
And I'm not going to get out of this without Karen.
Nope. She
got
to come too.
Karen got to come. Karen got to do some work. Karen got to do some work, but Karen got to come.
Yep.
I can't get out of it without her.
I like to say that my goal in life is to build spaces where everyone is welcome and everybody's clear about the rules of engagement.
Yeah.
Like, you can come in here as long as you follow the rules. You can't just be up in here acting crazy. But you can be up in here, and until you're ready to come inside and follow the rules, you can sit outside in front of the door. But you can hear all the singing and smell the food and hear and feel the warm air coming out from inside.
There you go.
And maybe it'll entice you to get your act together, because you are, anytime you are ready to engage in your full humanity, with our full humanity, you are welcome to come inside.
Yeah, that's what I love. That's what I love. And it's interesting, because those are the spaces that I have had the, you know, blessing to build when I built, you know, Impact Hub Oakland, was that space of come on in here and come on in here right, and let's get right together.
Yeah.
And let's get right together. Well, you know, we've had our time, and I just have to say, wow.
I love you so much. Thank you for having me. And thank you for living a life that I can follow.
I don't know who's following who. I just think we side by side right now, my sister.
I'm here for it. Let's go. Let's
side by side. I love you. You take good care of yourself. Stay safe. Stay healthy.
You too.
And all this crazy virus. And we need you. We need you. Mm-hmm. We need you in your fullness, taking care of yourself and doing the good work. And many blessings to you, my friend. I love you.
I love you.
Peace and blessings.
I love this conversation. It's so good.
I know. We'll pick it up. We'll continue to pick it up. We'll be off.
See you in Memphis.
See you in Memphis. I'll be there. All right, love. Be all right. Well.
Okay. Bye-bye.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.